Good morning. I'm Tim Burkett, the guiding teacher here. Most of you know me. And today I would like to introduce our guest speaker, Andrea Martin. Andrea came to Zen Center many years ago, began coming here in 1978, went through initiation ceremony with Katagiri Roshi in 1980. She was one of his attendants, during the last year or two before his death. Got to know him quite well. 3 years ago, her book, her edited book of his writing, came out. Every moment is the universe.
Each moment is the universe.
And she's just finished a first draft of a biography of him as well. So, welcome, Andrea.
Thank you very much, Tim. Usually people adjust these microphones. Can everyone hear me? Okay. Good morning, and I welcome you this morning. Thank you, Tim. Did you receive a program this morning? I don't see people holding them too much. Okay, good. The title that I gave to the talk I want to give this morning is Ceaseless Effort. I'm pausing for a minute because there's a reflection on the paper that I brought with me that are my notes. I don't know if you can see it. There's like the window is casting some light on it and I can't see it, so I'm just going to adjust. Kind of a slave to my notes. Okay, that works. So, Ceaseless Effort is the working title that I'm using for the history of Katagiri Roshi's life that I'm working on, as Tim mentioned. I've been working on this for probably about a year or so. And Ceaseless Effort is one of the paramitas. And paramita is a bodhisattva practice of wisdom and compassion. And I feel that Ceaseless Effort captures what I saw of Katagiri Roshi's life of continuous effort to practice and teach Buddhism and Zen. As most of you know, Katagiri Roshi, Roshi, for people who don't know, is a title of respect, approximately meaning old teacher. So when you see Roshi, it's not the person's name, it's not their family name, it's like saying reverend, but it's at the back of the name. So he was Dainen Katagiri, but we call him Katagiri Roshi. He was my teacher. He left Japan in 1963 when he was 35 years old, and he first went to California, first more or less as a missionary sent by the Soto Zen organization in Japan to Los Angeles, where there was a temple of expatriate Japanese. And the temple served them, but there was also interest in translating Buddhist texts and how to bring Buddhism to America through the institution of Zen rather than through independent people, as it kind of ended up happening. When I met him in 1978, I was 30, he was 50, and he was just here. I knew that he had been in California. I knew that he had come to Minnesota in 1972. I knew those things about him, but for me, from my own point of view, he was just here, kind of like Yoda. He was the Zen master. No. I didn't give a whole lot of thought to how he got here. It didn't seem important. Although, little by little, I did get to have a sense of him as a person because he talked a lot about himself in his talks. He used examples from his own life and always looked at his own life quite reflectively, sometimes humorously. But it may be like a child. You know, when you're a child, you don't really think about your parents and how they got here. You just think about your relationship with them. And then when you're older, suddenly you get a passion for genealogy and you want to know everything there was to know about your parents. That happened to me anyway. I don't know about the rest of you. So this year, 2010, is the 20th anniversary of his death. He died in 1990. He was 62 years old. And it was a huge disappointment to many, many people around the country and the world. So this being the 20th anniversary, it came to me that I wanted to do some recognition of that as a personal milestone in my life. The relationship you have with your teacher is, it seems to me, unique. It's not like any other relationship that you have with a human being. You can't even say what it is exactly. It's love, it's respect, it's appreciation. It stays with you for your whole life when you meet someone and interact with them at the deep level that you do with your teacher. And I also, in my life here at Zen Center, I manage the Katagiri Roshi Archives and am involved with the digitization of his audio archive. So I also felt that it would be really great if we had an authoritative, let's say, history of his life. There's a lot of bits and pieces around there about his life, but I felt as an archivist and as a librarian that it would be nice, which was my profession, to bring everything together and to have it all kind of tidy. And I felt that that would be a meaningful thing for me to do this year. So I had a pretty simple intention to just gather everything together, kind of like a librarian, you know, put it in one place and write it up. It seemed simple. Yeah, that's the way it goes, isn't it? But it hasn't really been simple. When you start writing something up, you realize you need to, it has to be a story, you know, there has to be a beginning and things have to kind of make sense and flow along. And it turns out there was a lot of missing information and people's memories weren't really, you know, 20 years, 30 years later, 40 years later, people didn't remember everything the same way. And it's been interesting trying to piece together something that accounts for everything and works as a document. And also, maybe what I didn't expect, the hardest part about it, is that I have to find a way to represent him accurately. You know, I think taking responsibility to represent some other person's life, to say something that's true and accurate about another person's life, especially when you weren't there for most of it, is more of a burden than I expected. I hadn't thought about that aspect of it. But I'm still close to the end with it, close to a point where I feel like I can let it go and let other people fill in any gaps that I might have left or inaccuracies I might have portrayed. based on their own memories or knowledge. The other thing that I have been doing recently, and sort of in parallel, is I've been reading the biography of Bede Griffiths. He was Alan Griffiths before his religious life, and he was given the name Bede Griffiths. He was an older contemporary of Katagiri Roshi. He died in 1993, 3 years after Katagiri did. But when he died, he was 87, so he had a much longer life. He was British. He was a Benedictine monk, and he went to India in 1955 at the age of 49, and he eventually developed a Christian ashram there. He was the author of several widely loved books for people who are interested in a deeper view of Christianity. He is somebody that people like to read. He was very reportive about his own spiritual quest, and I think people could really identify with some of the issues he was grappling with. So he became one of several Western religious leaders who were famous in the 20th century for bringing the wisdom of the East to Western religion. He devoted his life to learning and introducing contemplative practices to Christianity. He was very much aware of the mystical element in religion, including Christianity, and he talked a lot about the Godhead, for example, rather than God as an individual person. Not person, but, you know, creator. There were, as I was reading him, I just consistently noticed parallels that came to mind between the two men's lives. Katagiri coming from the East to the West in 1963, Griffiths going from the East to the West in 1955, and neither of them ever went back. Once they came, they stayed. And they both wanted and tried to plant seeds for the future. But by the end of their life, both of them felt some sense of failure that no one else could really understand, but that they were quite humble and felt that they had not accomplished what they were responsible for doing. There's one thing, though, that really sticks with me from the story of their two lives, and that is how bold they had to be in the human world to create the opportunities to do what they did. I think talking about the spiritual quest, it can just seem so lofty, so pure, so idealized. But it unfolds on, and it depends on, the messy reality of everyday life. Katagiri became a monk when he was 18. He served in World War II against his will. He was 16, and the government of Japan required that all boys above the age of 13 contribute to the war effort, and he was essentially forced to serve. He served in the army and the Air Force aspect of the army, and he was a mechanic, so he was on the battlefield, not fighting, but servicing airplanes that contained Japanese pilots. And when he returned from the war, Japan was just in total chaos. There wasn't enough to eat. He started working, and he was just really, really unhappy. So he decided to become a monk. But it wasn't entirely just from dissatisfaction, but from a sense of peace that he had realized when he was in temples and recollection of a priest that he had known when he was a child. And I think the thing that really surprised me when I was working on his history, and that continues to come back to me when I think about it, is how he was so often dissatisfied with his circumstances, and that he made choices that other people that were close to him didn't want him to make. When he decided to become a monk, his father was angry with him. His father was old, he was virtually blind, and he wanted him to stay with him. I don't really know how it is or was in Japan, but Katagiri was the youngest child in his family. And I know in my family, which is of an Italian heritage, that the youngest child was supposed to stay home and take care of the parents in their old age. I don't know if that was what he was expected of him or not, but his father wanted him to be there, and he left. He went to the monastery. And once he was ordained and living at his teacher's temple, he wanted to go to Eheiji to train as a monk, and his teacher didn't want him to go. His teacher wanted him to go someplace else. And Katagiri was just very persistent in wanting to go to Eheiji, and his teacher finally let him go. And once he was out of Eheiji and back at the temple, he was unhappy, which he was always quite clear about the fact that he admitted he was unhappy, and he wanted to go to college and study Buddhism formally, and his teacher didn't want him to go. So he found a way to go, eventually getting a lot of his tuition paid by the Zen Buddhist structure. Once he was out of college and he had to work for a couple of years at Soto headquarters because of his scholarship, he returned to his teacher's temple, and then Soto Zen headquarters wanted to send him to America, and his teacher didn't want him to go. Well, first they wanted to send him to Brazil. In Brazil, there's another expatriate community of Japanese living in Brazil, and they wanted to assign him there, and his teacher said, no, he can't go. And then later they wanted to send him to America, and his teacher finally said, okay, and he came to America. In America, he was at an organization in Los Angeles that I mentioned earlier, and he wasn't happy there. He was supposed to be there for 2 years, but before that time was up, he left. He walked out, as far as I can tell from reading his story, putting it together. He went to San Francisco and was eventually drawn into the San Francisco Zen Center that Suzuki Roshi was creating. He served Suzuki then for 7 years, and he decided to leave. So, and Suzuki didn't want him to. It was before Suzuki died, but he decided to leave anyway. He formed his own small Zen center in Monterey, California, and came here soon after that. The one in Monterey was a temporary device Suzuki didn't want him to leave, but once it was realized that Suzuki was dying, then Katagiri agreed that he would stick around for a while to help with the transition. And then he came here. So by the time he got here, all that had already happened, and I didn't know anything about that. It doesn't seem, I mean, you think of the spiritual path, and it's all so, it just sort of unfolds, and, you know, you're called to serve, and you serve, and you know, you everybody knows what you're supposed to do, and you do it. Well, I'm really glad he made all those decisions. And if he hadn't, we wouldn't be here right now. There wouldn't be a Zen center. There wouldn't be books. There wouldn't be the enormous diaspora that has occurred from his lineage and from all the people who studied with him. Bede Griffith, and this is what interested me, was so, it had something similar that happened in his life. He had a very profound spiritual experience in nature when he was 17 years old. And it became a touchstone of his life, something that he felt he needed to understand what had happened. And he studied philosophy, trying to understand it. When he was 21, a friend of his mother gave him three books, the Bhagavad Gita, the Dhammapada, and the Tao Te Ching. And this was, you know, way before those books were commonly read. It wasn't that reading them suddenly gave him an insight and changed his life. It was one of many, many things that he was reading. But I think that it did plant a seed that flourished later. When he was 23, he had another very profound spiritual experience of realizing the strength of his ego and trying to face it. He experienced a dark night experience of the abyss and learned that he needed to surrender. His action after that was to convert to Catholicism and ordain as a Benedictine monk. There wasn't a contemplative tradition in Christianity at that time, and he forged a path to meditation on his own, pretty much. That's the way I read the book. He had a passion to go to India, and it took him many, many years to realize that passion, but he was really persistent in pushing to find a way to get there through his life as a monk. Oh, excuse me, but this is taking a lot longer than I thought. When I wrote these notes up, I thought, this is just, you know, the beginning. Now it's taking so long. So I'm going to skip over some of that. Anyway, he formed this ashram in India, and the thing that I wanted to just say in a nutshell about him was that he claimed later he was sent to India, but actually he had manipulated in a way his circumstances, and he wasn't really welcome there. He went even though the welcome mat wasn't out, and he was excused from a couple of places before he actually landed at Shantivanam. And after that, history praises him for everything that he did. But at the time, some people said that he couldn't be considered a saint because he always got his own way. So I've been thinking about this dissatisfaction, this lack of contentment, this having desires that these two men manifested when I read their stories. And that's a big theme in Buddhism, talking about desire and dissatisfaction. You know, we think about it a lot, how to deal with that. In the Shobo Genzo, that's Dogen's famous teaching, the last chapter, which he wrote in the last year of his life, so it's his last writing, and he called on the last teaching of Buddha, and he said, he wrote about the eight awarenesses of the enlightened person. That was based on the Nirvana Sutra. And number one, the way Katagiri translated it and when he talked about it, was having less desires. Thomas Cleary translated it, having few desires. Number two, knowing how to be satisfied. Cleary's translation, being content. So there's a little difference there. But seen from the point of view of enlightenment, there is deep contentment that comes from realizing that there's nothing to desire, nothing to be desired, no one to desire it. But we have to be careful not to mix up the enlightened view of contentment with the relative view of contentment. If you do, you risk becoming passive. It seems to me that having desire and feeling dissatisfaction aren't necessarily bad. They're informative. It's like any emotion, any idea, it's an opportunity to examine our life and to think carefully about what we should do. According to the Four Noble Truths, dissatisfaction is suffering when our desires are ego-centered and out of touch with our true nature. So what we want to think about is how we can use dissatisfaction, use desire to grow and mature without falling prey to our ego and being in true suffering from them. Well, Dogen said in the Eight Awarenesses of the Enlightened Person that Buddha's last teaching was the Eight Awarenesses. I'm not going to go back and read the others. You can look it up if you want to. But it's not what we think of when we think of Buddha's famous last words. There's many accounts of Buddha's dying, but the one we think of was that he said, "Apo dipo bhava." And it's usually understood as, "Be a light unto yourself." It was spoken to his disciple Ananda, who was crying and worrying that his world would go dark without the light of Buddha to guide him. So it's sometimes used as an exhortation to trust yourself. And the danger there is it can be kind of individualistic. You know, you're trusting yourself, but you're not getting the deep trust in the base of your life. It's a danger there, I think. So there's another translation that I encountered when I was looking into this, and I love this other translation. I think it works for me. Let yourself act as a lamp unto you. And in the let the self is a capital S, self. Well, capitalization is always a clue in Buddhism. When it's lowercase, it's kind of like the everyday world, and when it's uppercase, it's the deeper world of true reality. So I think that S in the self, it takes it out of the realm of the individual truth based on ego and into the universal self that's always manifesting the truth. Katagiri said, "To inquire deeply into the truth of the self, we must follow exactly the truth that the ancestors sought for and not nurture individual selfishness. This is the meaning of self-realization and self-enlightenment. It is a matter of fact that to live out the truth of the self is absolutely different from wanting one's own way in everything." So I guess the big question is, how do you let yourself act as a lamp unto you? And this is the spiritual path that we are following by being here. We are trying to touch something deep in the heart of our life. If you experience yourself as not separate from the world around you, you see that your life is already completely filled with everything. There is nothing missing. Your life is already supported. Then you can come back to human life. You can look around you with a calm mind. Then you can decide what to do. Then you can act with confidence and full commitment to whatever it is that you feel you have to do. So on the program, there's a quote. I will read it. "The purpose of Zen practice is not to gain the Buddha nature, nor to become Buddha, nor to attain enlightenment through the practice, but to learn the way how to deal with the Buddha nature we are already endowed with." I found this quote in Katagiri Roshi's papers when I was doing research for his history. There's no indication in the notebook I found it in of where it comes from. I don't know if he wrote it. I don't know if he translated it from something, copied it down from someplace. It doesn't sound like exactly native English language. There's a little something funny about it, so I don't know. But I immediately copied it down, and I've revisited it numerous times. For me, it captures the heart of his teaching. It encourages us to touch the mystery of what we are, what a human being is in the huge perspective of life, and then use that awareness as a guide to living as a human being in the best possible way. It's not saying that there is no enlightenment. It's just saying that there's nothing separate to gain. There's nothing to become. There's nothing to attain, because Buddha is already warm in our hearts. It's already nurturing our lives. When we realize that, our outlook shifts subtly. We feel that we belong here. We're better able to decide what to do in the circumstances we find ourselves in. Katagiri used to talk about being the master of yourself in whatever situation you are. You can do that by calling on something within yourself that helps you know what to do. It's really a question of deciding what needs to be done rather than what we need to get out of the situation. I think both Katagiri and Griffiths had a sense of direction, a sense of purpose that they depended on, because it had developed out of contact with the truth. It was a dim image, as Katagiri used to say. It was a favorite expression of his. You don't really know what it is. Your mind can't get around it. It's a dim image, but you have a feeling that there's something there to be done. I think this informed their dissatisfaction, and it pushed them along a path that led to them helping many, many people to deepen their own lives. When I think about my teacher, I feel so thankful that he came to Minnesota and that I was able to study with him. But what was the cost to others of his dissatisfaction? When you read or hear the Buddha legend, people today often criticize Buddha because he made a hard decision to leave his family and to pursue a spiritual path. In Katagiri's case, his father didn't want him to be a priest. His teacher didn't want him to leave. Suzuki didn't want him to leave. And in the end, he reconciled with his father, and his father was very happy. His teacher never had another student. He had had many before Katagiri. Katagiri, in the end, was his last student. No one ever came to be his student again, and he died alone. But when I say that, I think, you know, his teacher was very, very attached to him. And I always keep that in mind. I don't know what to make of it exactly, but it's the other side of the story. Suzuki Roshi was making his own decisions, and that there was a bigger context in which Katagiri decided to leave the San Francisco Zen Center. And a lot of people stayed with him after he left. Katagiri retained a connection to the San Francisco Zen Center throughout the rest of his life, even while he was here. Katagiri said something in one of his talks another thing that I go back to over and over again, because, you know, I don't think you get through life without making tough decisions. And it's not always clear what the right choice is. we have to make choices and we have to take responsibility for our decisions. Katagiri said, "Personally, in my mind, I really apologize to my teacher, but I cannot stay feeling guilty. The more I feel guilty, the more I have to devote myself, offering my life to the Buddha Dharma. That is the best way of apologizing." I think that all we can do is to continue to make our best effort. And then we use whatever happens as fertilizer to deepen our lives and understand better what to do in our life, whatever we're faced with. So ceaseless effort. I think this is our practice. I think it's what Katagiri did. I think it's what we have to do. And I think it's what the universe is doing. The universe is constantly supporting our life. It's always there. It's always the dynamic aspect of life. It's always working. In Zen, we talk about total dynamic working. It's the practice of the universe to constantly create itself. And for us, we can realize that in Zazen. It is the practice of aligning ourselves with the ceaseless effort of the universe and becoming one with it. Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much. I finished in time for questions. So if anyone has comments or questions or would like to pursue any of these points, please. Now you may. Jeff.
This is an example, I think, of ceaseless effort. Ralph Lemon is a dancer, artist, choreographer, and his work is being presented at the Walker over this weekend. One of the parts of this presentation was an evening performance last night of he and his company. At one point during the performance, the stage was empty. There was nobody there. And a woman, one of the performers, offstage, began sobbing uncontrollably. Minutes passed. It was very difficult to experience this outpouring of anguish and grief. And then a kind of a shift happened, for me anyway, and I realized I had felt this as a small child, as an adult, exactly, this. One minute passed. This went on. And I then understood that I have made choices in my life that have caused others to feel this, exactly this. And at this moment, there are untold numbers of people who are feeling exactly this anguish, this despair, this loss, this grief. Look at the Middle East, for instance. This is an example. But what the performance left me with was the realization that we are all so connected to each other at such a deep and profound level. And this connection is so deep and profound that the conscious mind loses track of that fact. And I was very grateful for the opportunity to make contact with that understanding again.
That deep despair, that is something so connected, I think, with surrendering. It's so reaching the limit, just the utmost limit of your power as an ego-based person. There's nothing left to do. You don't know what to do. You just, you know, you've run out. That profound despair can launch you on the spiritual quest, the true spiritual quest. There's something purifying about it. It's like a relief almost to touch that deep space where, you know, you can't operate the way you know how to operate. You have to give it up. You have to let it go. And you have to let the whole universe as it really is just come into your life. Is, you know, I know. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm.